From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, Dean Kamen, the inventor of the Segway Human Transporter, the new high-tech scooter that relies on gyroscopes and computer software to produce a balanced ride. He also invented a portable drug infusion pump, a kidney dialysis unit for home use, and a wheelchair that climbs stairs. The Segway will be available to consumers next month. 33 states have passed laws allowing its use on sidewalks, but many pedestrians are worried this may be dangerous. San Francisco has banned Segways from the sidewalks. We'll talk with Bruce Lee Livingston of the Senior Action Network, who helped lead the opposition. Also, rock critic Ken Tucker reviews Up, the new double CD by country singer Shania Twain. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Iraq apparently has given in to one of the demands of UN weapons inspectors trying to determine whether Iraq is hiding banned weapons. Iraq's ambassador to the UN says Baghdad has agreed that the inspectors may conduct surveillance flights over Iraq using American U-2 spy planes. NPR's Vicky O'Hara reports.
Iraq seems to be offering more cooperation as inspectors prepare for a critical report to the UN Security Council on Friday. What the inspectors say will influence how the council decides to proceed. Inspectors Hans Blix and Mohammed Al-Baradei visited Baghdad over the weekend, seeking answers to a list of questions about Iraq's arsenal. The inspectors also were demanding that Iraq guarantee the safety of U-2 surveillance flights. Baghdad previously said it couldn't do that unless U.S. and British planes suspended air patrols over northern and southern Iraq during the surveillance flights. The inspectors say Iraq also has turned over some documents concerning anthrax, nerve gas, and missile programs. Blix says analysts will have to study the contents. Vicky O'Hara, NPR News, Washington.
President Bush charged today that Iraqi leader Saddam Hussein is stationing his soldiers among the civilian population in case of a U.S. attack on Iraq.
Saddam Hussein regards the Iraqi people as human shields, entirely expendable when their suffering serves his purposes.
Speaking today in Nashville, the president told a group of religious broadcasters that if civilians are hurt during U.S. attacks, Iraq could then blame coalition forces. Mr. Bush repeated his charge that Saddam Hussein has broken every promise to disarm. Attorney General John Ashcroft told the Council on Foreign Relations today that much of the world supports the U.S. war on terrorism. NPR's Andrea Seabrook reports.
Ashcroft hearkened back to U.S. support of the British during the World War II bombing blitz in 1941 to illustrate the deep belief in freedom the two countries still share. But, he said, today there is a new type of ideological divide among nations.
Where once we saw a world divided between East and West, today we see a new model of division, a model not based on ethnicity or geography. The gulf between nations now separates those devoted to the rule of law from those devoted to the tyranny of terrorism.
In his speech, Ashcroft did not mention France or Germany, neither of which supports U.S. action against Iraq. He said America has made the choice to fight terrorism not just for its own freedom, but for that of the world. Andrea Seabrook, NPR News, the Capitol.
In stocks today, the Dow Industrials gained 56 points to close at 7,920 in active trading. Advancing issues led declines by a small margin. The Nasdaq gained 14 points. This is NPR News. Divers are searching for wreckage from the Columbia shuttle disaster in a reservoir on the Texas-Louisiana border. Fishermen had reported debris falling into the Toledo Bend Reservoir, but the search was delayed by bad weather. The head of a Muslim charity based in Chicago has entered a guilty plea, but not to funneling money to Osama bin Laden's terrorist network, as the government originally charged. NPR's Cheryl Corley reports.
As part of the plea bargain, prosecutors dropped the charges that Iman Arnot aided bin Laden. Instead, the head of the nearly defunct Benevolence International Foundation pleaded guilty to illegally using funds for charity to buy boots, uniforms, and an ambulance for fighting forces in Bosnia and Chechnya. Arnot's attorney, Joseph Duffy, said the government had changed its position.
I think the plea agreement is a recognition by them that this organization has nothing to do with terrorism.
But U.S. Attorney Patrick Fitzgerald says the government was not walking away from its contention that the charity was involved with Al-Qaeda.
not in your life. We're very clear it was. We stand by that, and I'm not mincing words.
Government officials said they agreed to the plea bargain to secure a conviction. Cheryl Corley, NPR News, Chicago.
A Sikh militant pleaded guilty today to taking part in the 1985 bombing that killed all 329 people aboard an Air India jet. Inderjit Singh Rayat pleaded guilty to a manslaughter charge in the bombing, which caused the plane to crash off the Atlantic coast of Ireland. Rayat announced his plea in a courtroom in Vancouver, Canada, less than 2 months before he was scheduled to stand trial. The bombing was allegedly committed in revenge after the Indian Army stormed the Golden Temple, Sikhism's holiest shrine. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Keen, helping clients manage business performance through business consulting, application development and integration, and application outsourcing. Keen, we get IT done.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The new high-tech scooter, known as the Segway Human Transporter, will be available to consumers starting in March. Most people seem to agree it's a pretty cool invention. Yet there's a lot of worry surrounding its use. The company that manufactures the Segway is lobbying for the right to use it on sidewalks, and 33 states have passed legislation allowing that. But many pedestrian and senior citizen groups are worried that these vehicles could collide with pedestrians, causing serious injuries. A little later, we'll hear from one of the activists who led the campaign banning the Segway from the sidewalks of San Francisco. First, we're going to hear from the Segway's inventor, Dean Kamen. Until the Segway, he was best known for his medical inventions, including a portable insulin pump, a kidney dialysis machine for home use, a heart stent, and a motorized wheelchair that can climb stairs. We'll talk about some of these inventions later, but let's start with the Segway. I asked Dean Kamen to describe what it looks like and how it works.
The best way to describe how it works or how it feels is like a pair of magic sneakers. It looks like a low platform about 6 inches high on which you stand, and there's a small shaft, a handle comes up, which ends up looking like the handles of a bicycle. And you have two wheels, but instead of like a bicycle where they're one in front and one in back, each one is just outside your left and right foot. So when you first look at it, you'd say, this thing must be unstable. It's missing either its front or rear axle. But in the platform that you're standing on, there are a set of 5 gyroscopes that are sensing any kind of motion, acceleration, tilt of the platform. And they feed 9 different computers, lots of information in real time. And those computers send signals out to the wheels in such a way that if the machine were even very slightly tipped forward, the wheels would run under it forward. If the machine were tilted backward, they would run backward.
When you were researching this Segway and figuring out what the computers and the gyroscopes needed to do, did you, like, walk a lot and try to analyze what your body was doing as you were walking?
Well, actually, it's even more than that. The Segway really comes from a medical product that I worked on for more than 10 years. I've literally spent my entire adult life working on medical products. And one that we started many, many, many years ago was a product that I thought would be a way to give the disabled population a capability that virtually no product addresses. Those people, whether they're in wheelchairs because they have no capability to move their legs, or if they're in a wheelchair or using a walker or any other device because of whether it's Parkinson's disease or MS, we find ways to move those people around. But what they've lost is the ability that we all take for granted to do something uniquely human called walking. And so the more I looked at wheelchairs and how to improve them, the more I got frustrated. I mean, I could make a wheelchair climb stairs. You could make it look like a bulldozer or a tank. But finally, after years of being frustrated that we couldn't really do what we thought needed to be done, it suddenly occurred to us why. And that is, what they lost was the specific way to move around by standing up and balancing and having a small footprint and being with their colleagues in conversation eye to eye. And so we said, you know, let's not improve the wheelchair. Let's figure out how to restore effectively human balance. And that set me on a 10-year expedition into understanding this very subtle and, frankly, from an engineering point of view, very difficult process of understanding balance and walking. We did it. We built a device called an iBot, which literally allows a disabled person to cruise down the hallway at eye level with their peers, balanced on two wheels the way their peers are balanced on their feet. It allows them to go step up and down curbs and literally walk up and down stairs. And we spent so much time trying to understand and finally succeeding in understanding how humans ambulate and balance and walk that we realized we could take the same technology and apply it to the Segway and make this technology available to the rest of the population.
So getting back to the actual design of the Segway, how do you steer it and how do you adjust the speed of it?
Forward and back, there's no clutch, there's no brakes, there's no throttle, there's no accelerator, there's no gear shift. There is only one control on the whole machine. And in your left hand, almost like the throttle would be on a motorcycle, there's a rotating member. And if you rotate it to the left, like a little steering wheel, the machine turns to the left. If you rotate it to the right, the machine turns to the right. That is the only control on the machine. And when you combine that wrist coordination with your thinking forward, thinking stop, or thinking backwards, after a little while, you literally can dance around a room. If you were just here, I would just put you on the machine, and you would cruise down the hall, you would turn around, you would come back to me smiling, and when you got back to me, you would just stop.
No,
you wouldn't know how you stopped. You'd just stop, and you'd smile, and you'd say, I get it.
Are you saying that because the gyroscopes and the computers are very complicated, and you couldn't explain how they work any easier than you could explain how our brains
work? Yeah, the way the gyros work, I could explain very easily. Imagine that the gyroscope, and there's a bunch of them, and they're redundant, so if something happens to one of them, it doesn't affect the performance or safety of the machine. But a gyroscope is sitting there, for instance, one of them is vertical, and it always wants to be vertical. And if you stand on this platform, and since it only has two wheels and they're side by side, any subtle motion of your body that puts your center of mass in front of the point of contact of those wheels would start to tip the platform forward. Everybody's familiar with that concept. That's why when they look at this machine, they're so familiar with that concept, they say, my God, it'll fall over. But as soon as it starts to tip by any amount, the gyros sense that tip. They send information to the computers. The computers look at how much it's tipping, how much the rate of change of tipping is either increasing or decreasing, and how much the rate of change of the rate of change, in other words, the position, the velocity, and the acceleration of that platform are all being measured in real time very, very frequently. And as a function of how much tip there is, those computers determine how much power to send to the motors so that the motors will torque those wheels to run in the direction of the tip so that they will return it to being vertical while they move. And so as you get on this machine, you never really feel a tipping, but if you kind of start to lean forward as if you were doing what you naturally do to take a step, those motors will just make those wheels move you forward while the platform appears to you to not have leaned over very much. If you decide I don't want to go any further, your natural instinct is to kind of lean back. And as soon as you lean back, the platform senses, or the gyro sense that the platform is now leaning back, it takes the torque away from the motors and stop it, or in fact move it backwards.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Dean Kamen, and he is the inventor of the Segway. Now, a lot of pedestrian groups are very concerned about the Segway, and San Francisco has banned the Segway on city streets. The concerns include that a motorized vehicle on sidewalks or pedestrians walk can be threatening to pedestrians, particularly the elderly, people who are frail, people whose walking is impaired, people whose hearing is impaired, and they might not notice that there's a vehicle behind them. But really, any pedestrian walking down the street could conceivably be injured by a heavy, motorized scooter or vehicle, whatever you'd want to call it. So what's your argument for on behalf of allowing Segways on sidewalks of city streets?
Well, first, I'd like to say you said that they were, I think the word you used was banned from the streets of San Francisco. Actually, I believe they're just fine on the streets of San Francisco. What we had attempted to do...
I meant sidewalks.
Right, well, big difference.
Yeah.
Once we were able to make a device that moves like a pedestrian, stops like a pedestrian, can spin in place and do pirouettes better than most people except maybe a ballerina... we had a device that has a footprint as small as a pedestrian. It leaves you at eye level with other people. Your hands, again, it would be much easier to have this discussion with you or anybody if you had some experience with the machine. But once a person uses it and sort of adopts it as an extension of themselves, it becomes pretty clear to anybody on it that you certainly wouldn't want to be out in the street in front of a bus. You're standing there, you're backing up, you're spinning around like any other pedestrian. You're just a little bit more empowered.
Yeah, but here's the thing. Say you're walking down the street, you know, and I'll just speak for myself here. I'm usually walking down the street oblivious because I'm thinking about something and I'm not necessarily thinking about where I am or what's going on around me. And then I might suddenly stop and say, did I bring my keys?
Right.
And suddenly I've stopped. I'm checking for my keys. Say there's a Segway right behind me that's going three times the speed that I'm walking. The Segway won't necessarily be able to stop as quickly as I've stopped. So, I mean, that's a kind of, I think, typical pedestrian concern.
I think that is the typical pedestrian concern, and that's why I think we need to educate people and let them experience this. Because, in fact, if somebody were behind you, and you were walking along on a crowded sidewalk and they were behind you, they wouldn't be going three times as fast as you. And if you were to stop, your natural instinct to stop, even if you suddenly stopped quickly, their natural instinct would be about the same, and the stopping distances from the same speeds are about the same. I can simply tell you that in 100,000 hours of use now on the sidewalks, there's been no such occurrence.
But, you know, here's the thing. It's a little difficult to judge from experiences to this point because how many people have Segways? So if there's a Segway being used on a sidewalk, it might be the only Segway in town. If it really catches on and there's lots of people in city sidewalks using the Segway, then the whole nature of pedestrian traffic patterns starts to change.
And frankly, we hope you're right. And again, we've thought about that for many years. The first thing I would say is I agree with you. We don't have a lot of experience. And the only way to get experience with any new thing is to be open-minded and try it. And all we have been doing as we go around the country trying to show people what this option might do for them is to have them say, let's try it. But I would also tell you that as we gain experience and see that they mix well with pedestrians, to your question, which was what happens when there's a lot of them, I guess there's many answers. But if it turns out that there are not going to be a lot of them, then this isn't an issue worth anybody's big concern. If it turned out there would be a lot of them, then what will happen is the infrastructure will make appropriate adjustments.
Dean Kamen invented the Segway human transporter. We'll talk about his medical inventions later in the show, but first we'll hear why and how San Francisco banned the Segway from the city's sidewalks. That's after a break. This is Fresh Air. The Segway human transporter will be available to consumers starting next month. It's already being used in the Disney planned community of Celebration, Florida, as well as at Disney theme parks. The post office has tested Segways for mail deliveries and is still evaluating the results. Several police departments have experimented with the Segway. The Atlanta police are testing the Segway at Hartsfield Airport. The Los Angeles Metro Transit Authority just purchased some Segways for evaluation. The biggest controversy surrounding the Segway surrounds its use on sidewalks, where critics say it could be dangerous for pedestrians. 33 states have passed laws allowing the Segway on sidewalks. San Francisco is the first and currently the only city to ban the Segway from its sidewalks. I spoke with Bruce Lee Livingston, who helped lead the opposition. He's the executive director of the Senior Action Network and is a longtime health and environmental activist. He says that seniors are particularly vulnerable to being hurt by a Segway on the sidewalk.
There's no question that seniors are especially vulnerable. When they are knocked down, they can suffer a bone injury that can be permanent. It's the classic case of the hip injury. And they might not necessarily be able to move out of the way as fast as other people. But it's not just seniors. It's everybody who uses the sidewalk. We cannot allow every new instrument that's invented to be put on the sidewalks to replace pedestrians. We have to put new commuter vehicles or any other vehicle in the road. The only vehicles we allow on the sidewalk are motorized wheelchairs, which people with disabilities use. So we can't just allow them to be congested with other instruments.
Is it possible that seniors would actually benefit if they were able to use Segways on the sidewalk? Because a lot of seniors have trouble walking more than a block or so, and they don't necessarily drive. So, you could make the argument that the Segway would enable them to go shopping, to visit friends who live nearby but slightly too far away to walk.
Well, I don't even think I've heard the company try to make that argument because, you have to stand up on the Segway scooter. You have to find a way to carry things on the scooter. But even if you had a few seniors that were mobile and strong enough to use a Segway scooter, you would have to worry about the other ones who are on the sidewalk who can't use them. So we just can't put these new vehicles out there to the detriment of everybody else who uses the sidewalk.
Did you try a Segway yourself?
Well, actually, I did. It's become a little bit of a famous incident. When we were asking the state not to pass the law allowing the Segway scooters, the corporation asked that they meet with us, and they brought the scooter up into our boardroom. And I got on it, and I'm fairly athletic, and I wanted to see what you could do with it if you had malintent. And I ran into five chairs, and they flew across the room. And it's because, it's got the self-stopping system that if you want to stop and you're aware, you can stop it. But if you want to accelerate, it has tremendous acceleration and tremendous power. So that's what happened, and we were shocked at how much power it has. So if somebody's not paying attention, or if someone has malintent, or perhaps even if somebody is drunk. So we'd like to see our agencies take a look at this and not just abdicate the responsibility and leave it up to little cities to try to figure out whether it's safe or not.
San Francisco was the first city in the nation to ban Segways from the sidewalk. You were part of the campaign to convince the city supervisors to ban the Segway. Was it a hard sell on your part?
Well, like everything, it's a hard sell. There was a lot of lobbying by the corporation, and as I said, they have lobbied extensively throughout the country. But we have a very strong and mobile active senior voice here, and half of our pedestrian deaths are senior citizens. And we just had to say that this is a pedestrian safety issue, as it should be.
What were your impressions of the Segway lobby when this bill was being discussed?
Well, in California, the Segway Corporation hired a group that we refer to as CAPAO, which is the largest lobbying firm in Sacramento. And they hired them. They brought their scooter into the Capitol and got people on this thing. It's a wonderful technology. It is actually fun, which is why we're glad to see that it's being used on Disney cruises, and I think it's going to be used in some other Disney locations. But we think it should be tested out in small environments, in amusement parks, and it should be tested for street use, possibly in bicycle lanes. What they did was they very rapidly put it through with this pro-environment kind of rhetoric. And here in California, we found out about that very late. If it's going to be pro-environment, it has to be, again, on the streets. There wasn't much we could do. It was already in the second house in the Appropriations Committee. You can't testify on anything except perhaps insurance issues. So it was very far along in the process. And it's just unfortunate that what happens is it gets left up to the cities. We made sure that there was legislation, that wording that very clearly said that we could ban it at the local levels. But that's a tremendous effort. So now it's going on in many cities and areas in the Bay Area, such as Santa Cruz, San Mateo, Berkeley, Emeryville, Oakland. They're all considering ordinances now to ban it from the sidewalks.
Do you think the Segway is safe on the streets? You're banning it from the sidewalks in San Francisco, but do you think it's safe on the streets? And I ask this because, you know, in a lot of cities, the lanes aren't very wide. There isn't necessarily a bicycle lane. So you've got cars going at one speed in the same area that you've got bicycles going at a slower speed, and now Segways going at an even slower speed.
Well, it may not be safe on the streets, and that's something the corporation will have to deal with and our public agency should look at. But we shouldn't, therefore, put it on the sidewalk and threaten walkers. We should look at this new technology as an opportunity. Let's thoroughly test it. In the environmental movement, we call it the precautionary principle, which is that before we put something out on the market, we should do some testing, have some precautions, and make sure that it's safe. So this is an opportunity to get something that's good for the environment out there. Is it as safe as a bicycle or a motorcycle, which is on the streets? I'm not sure. Maybe we need helmet laws or knee pads. I certainly think we should have insurance requirements and age limits, and we should limit its off-road use. But we wanted to make sure, and we went out very quickly saying that it does not belong on the sidewalks. That's why we had to do that. We knew we could pass that kind of ordinance. That's what we recommend other cities throughout the nation to do, is to look at, are your sidewalks wide enough?
When you did test out the Segway, I know you weren't a practiced user of it, but just, you know, as a novice stepping on for the first time, did you feel like you could control it?
Yes, I could. However, one of our senior activists, Jean Lynch, got on it, and she was terrified. And the Segway folks said, well, we would like to provide training for anybody who uses the scooter. That's not required by law, and there will be knockoffs if this is legal. So it won't be necessarily offered by any other corporation. So it is intimidating. You do have to learn to balance.
Well, Bruce Lee Livingston, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry.
Bruce Lee Livingston is the executive director of the Senior Action Network in San Francisco. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. From the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by Delta Trade Paperbacks, a division of Random House, publisher of Cinema Therapy for Lovers, The Couple's Guide to Finding Happiness One Movie at a Time, by Nancy Pesky and Beverly West. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, we continue our conversation with inventor Dean Kamen and talk about his medical inventions, which include a portable IV infusion unit, a kidney dialysis machine for home use, and a wheelchair that climbs stairs. And Ken Tucker reviews the new CD by Shania Twain.
Thank you.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Dean Kamen. Earlier in the show, we talked about his invention, the Segway Human Transporter. Most of his inventions are in the medical field, and several have changed the lives and even extended the lives of the people who use them. What was your first invention?
As a little kid, I was always frustrated that my mother, like everybody's mother, would tell me to make my bed in the morning. And when you're not much taller than the mattress, it takes a lot of trips running completely around the bed to get the cover up on one side and then up an even amount on the other side. And then at night, you tend to muss it all up. So it occurred to me that if I attached a pulley to each corner of the blanket and tied the other two corners at the foot of the bed to the rails, then in the morning, if the pulleys at the two top corners were properly organized, I could just take a rope, pull it, and the cover would immediately spring to its normal condition of a, quote, made bed. So it dramatically reduced the trauma of having to do that.
Your mother must have thought you were crazy.
I had very, very understanding parents.
So how long did you use this bed-making system?
Oh, my guess is until the novelty wore off. But I guess what was good about that experience to me was the idea that you could see a problem, think about a solution, some abstract idea, then with a couple of tools, you could reduce that abstract idea to some physical reality that solved the problem. And although I don't think there'd be a big commercial opportunity in bed makers, it sort of gave me a sense through the rest of my life that you look at the world, you find things that ought to be done differently to get a better outcome, and then you use more sophisticated tools than I had back then, like physics and engineering, and you reduce those abstract ideas to real products that help real people have a better life.
What was the first invention you sold?
The first invention I sold were, I guess today you'd call them light organs, or it was, as I was in high school, the world of semiconductors was exploding, and instead of transistors being able only to produce small amounts of power, for instance, to move the speakers in your headset, they made huge advances to where they could control thousands of watts. I think personally that was the birth of the disco is the result of the world of semiconductors. But you could take the output of that little amplifier that was running your speakers, run it through some of these kinds of new transistors called triacs and SCRs, and you could literally have the whole room, all the powered lights in the room, respond like music. I recognized that kids would like to do that in bands in these early days, and I started building equipment that would let them build light shows. I then started using the same equipment to run much more sophisticated light shows and, in fact, built the equipment that ran the Museum of Natural History Hayden Planetarium light show pretty much when I was in high school and going into college, and then started building boxes like that to run other museum shows and industrial shows. And I would take the money that I got from building these control boxes and just buy equipment with it, more electronic equipment, oscilloscopes, et cetera, until I finally filled up my parents' basement with a whole electronic shop. And then at the time, my older brother was in medical school, and he would come home on the weekends, and he would start to complain about his problems. Like, he was studying, he's an MD, PhD, and he was studying pediatric, very serious pediatric problems like leukemia in babies. And he'd come home and he'd say, you know, they make all this great equipment to deliver drugs to patients in a hospital, but all these patients are, you know, adults. And suddenly he had these great ideas on how to use new kinds of drugs to treat these preemies or pediatric patients, but none of the equipment could scale down to deliver these small volumes, and it couldn't fit in isolettes. And I suddenly started thinking that I was, you know, wasting my time building what were then silly devices when I could think about how to help him or make devices that might help these babies live.
So why don't you just list some of the things, some of the medical inventions that you've come up with?
So in those early days, I started building very small pumps to deliver drugs to babies. My brother used them while he was in medical school. We got exposed to a great community of research hospitals, Harvard, Yale. And as a result of getting feedback from different fields of medicine, hematology, oncology, I started building a whole line of miniature wearable pumps, eventually ending up building a wearable pump for diabetics to deliver their insulin a number of years later. And that whole medical company we then sold. We then went on to build other kinds of medical equipment, still in some ways for delivering or measuring fluid. We started building home portable dialysis equipment so people wouldn't have to spend two or three nights a week in a hospital being dialyzed. And we built things like stents, these devices made famous by the fact that Vice President Cheney has one of ours in him. But a small device that goes into the artery that you can get there via a catheter instead of by open heart surgery. And we build the iBot. We've already spoken about that, but that was a device to help the disabled community regain essentially the same capability that people have if they can balance and walk.
My guest is inventor Dean Kamen. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Dean Kamen. He invented the new high-tech scooter known as the Segway Human Transporter. He's also invented life-saving and life-enhancing medical innovations, including a kidney dialysis machine for home use, a portable insulin pump, and a wheelchair that climbs stairs. You may also be familiar with the work of his father, Jack Kamen. Your father was a comic book artist. He did comics for EC Comics and also drew for Mad Magazine. Did he kind of, by example, show you that daydreaming could actually pay off?
You know, people have asked me for most of my adult life why I chose to do what I do, and I have a lot of different answers. It was only a couple of years ago, and I guess due to the notoriety of some of our things, that people like you would say, what impact did your father have on you? And one of them actually answered the question rather than asked it and said, since your father was an entrepreneur, is that why you're an entrepreneur? And I looked right back at her and said, my father's not an entrepreneur. He's an artist. He doesn't know anything about business. My mother teaches bookkeeping in a high school, and as far as I know, she's written every check in their marriage for the last 56 years. My father is an artist. You can't be further from an entrepreneur. And she looked at me and said, well, he was self-employed, he creates things, and goes off and presents them to the world, and they either accept them or not. And it literally for the first time occurred to me that I probably, in many ways, have my perspective on the world due to the influence of my father.
Do you have any favorite comics or Mad Magazine things that your father has done over the years?
I have been collecting now for many years all the original art I can get that he did, and since comics have now become quite a collector's item, it's getting easier to find them. They're more expensive. You can go to Sotheby auctions now and get the originals. The most favorite one I have is the only comic I know that actually turned out to have a context of being about the artist, and it was done by Bill Gaines, then the owner, publisher of EC Comics. And he had asked my father to illustrate a horror story. And the running joke in the industry back then was my father was very good at drawing beautiful women, very sensual, but was terrible at the horror, the blood and guts with the heads ripped off in the comics. He just didn't do that. And the theme of the story, it's only a 6-page story, was that it starts out that my father is called into Bill Gaines' office and is fired because he can't make horrible drawings. And he says, oh, yes, I can. And the remaining frames, he goes home to talk to Evelyn, which is my mother's real name. And there she stands with a baby in her arms in one of these frames. And that's my older brother. And or actually, my older brother is standing next to her. He's about 4 years old, and I'm in her arms. And for some reason, Bill Gaines used the real names, my mother, who he knew well, us as children. And the story becomes, it comes to a happy ending because it was, in fact, a nightmare. It was done probably in 1953 or 54. I got the original of it. It's called Cayman's Calamity, Calamity spelled with a K. And the original of it was out in California. And I guess it's my favorite because my father was, he never wrote any of the dialogue, any, that's not what he does. He was an illustrator. But this whole thing was written about my father and his capability in art. And I have it hanging in my house right now.
So what are some of the comic series that your father illustrated?
My father was an illustrator for Shock, Horror, almost all the suspense stories of EC Comics, Tales from the Crypt, Psycho. He did, I believe, at least one story in every one of the EC series. And he did some Mad Magazine.
Did you read a lot of comics as a kid?
I'm embarrassed to tell you, I never read comics as a kid.
So many kids grew up with parents who thought that comic books were terrible and wanted to throw them out. Here you are growing up with a father who's actually drawing the comic books, and you didn't even read them, right?
Well, I have to tell you, not only did parents think that, but in the early days of McCarthyism, they actually banned comic books.
I know.
And that put my father in jeopardy. In fact, one of the reasons Mad Magazine came to be was Bill Gaines, the owner publisher of EC, suddenly found himself banned from selling his product. And he recognized that they have these kind of web presses and this space in the corner drugstore. What could they do instead of comic books? And Mad Magazine came out of that. And my father, who was an artist for him in the days of EC, then moved into doing that. My mother, of course, then had a pair of twins right after me and quickly decided that my father would be much better off doing serious commercial art than comic books. And he went freelance soon after that and never went back.
Right. Now, in addition to collecting your father's comic books, you collect old machines. Do you take them apart and see how they work?
I certainly do that, but I think you learn a whole lot more about the people than the machines when you look at 100-year-old technology. You look at what they were thinking.
Tell me about a favorite machine in your collection that's led you to interesting thoughts about humans and how they interact with machines.
Well, in almost every case, when you look at machinery from 100 years ago, what you realize is that people were focused on different kinds of issues and they had a different perspective of life. For instance, I have not only a 100-year-old machine, but the owner's manual that came with it. And it's a huge diesel engine. This engine, which happens to be sitting in my house, probably weighs 5,000 pounds. And it turned at such a low speed, you'd actually see the rotating parts work. And yet the bearings were huge. Individual bronze bearings must weigh 10 pounds apiece. And in the front page of the owner's manual, it says something like, proper care and attention to your engine will give you and your family generations of reliable service. Now, think of a product you've bought in your lifetime that you would consider something that you intend to give you and your family generations of reliable service. Your computer, by the time you buy it, is obsolete.
Right.
You know, things that we make that are held together by glue or Velcro or plastic flexible hinges, there's almost no product you buy today that will be operative in a few years. people had a very different perspective. So the way they built things were very different. The way they made parts of them accessible were very different. What they wanted the user to know about them were very different. And as you look at the technology, how it was created, what the intended goal was, you realize that there's much more in looking at old machines. And frankly, many of them are just beautiful. They would put curves and shapes in their cast iron castings that were there for nothing but aesthetics at a time when making curves and shapes was much, much more difficult than it is today with computer-controlled equipment. And today, we don't bother to do it. In old machinery, aesthetics was very important.
Now, I've read that you don't sleep very much, and I was wondering whether that was because you can't sleep or you don't want to sleep.
I'm not even sure that it's true that I don't sleep very much. I just tend to be up all night, but I don't get up real early in the morning like a lot of people do, and it was a struggle for me to get here on time today. I would say I go to bed at 2 or 3 in the morning unless something exciting is going on, in which case I might work all night, although these days I'm less capable of doing that than I used to be. But my theory on sleep is you don't go to bed until you're so tired that you know your head's going to hit the pillow and you're out, because thrashing around and wasting time that you could be working is just a bad thing. The problem with that, of course, is if you don't happen to get tired at the right time, you won't go to bed until you're out of sequence with your colleagues. And then if you go to bed at 3 or 4 or 5 in the morning, you're unlikely to be up at 7 when they want to have their 8 o'clock breakfast meeting. I then add to that, to the issue of only go to bed when you're tired, I would add the addendum, and only wake up when nature says it's time. So I hate having an alarm clock. If you're asleep, it's because your body wants to sleep. So it makes scheduling early morning meetings very difficult for me.
Well, thanks for showing up for our 9:30 a.m. interview. One last question. I know you have a private plane. I think you have a private helicopter. You obviously have a Segway or two around. I assume you have a car. Do you know how the planes work? I mean, being this inveterate inventor, do you have to, like, know how the plane works before you like to fly in it?
Oh, for sure. And actually, the main reason I originally got into helicopters is because I was fascinated by the dynamics of a helicopter. And it's, you know, although helicopters and airplanes both fly, they're very, very different kinds of technologies. And in fact, I ended up owning the company that built the helicopter that I fly.
Sure.
I don't anymore, but I was excited to understand them. And yes, I do a lot to understand the technology. And part of the fun to me of having these machines is the learning experience of staying up with the technology that's in them.
I'm going to squeeze in one more question. Have you actually needed to use any of the medical inventions that you've created?
I personally have not had to use them. Unfortunately, a number of my family members have had to use some of the products we've made. I have to tell you that I've always been excited, and you feel really good when you make a medical product that you know helps people. But I've always felt frustrated that I've never, ever wanted any of my friends or anybody I know to ever have to use my products, the labor of, you know, of my life. And one of the exciting things to us about building the Segway Human Transporter is we're finally building a product that we would actually like other people to want to buy. You know, nobody says, "Dean, that's a great stent. I can't wait until my coronary artery clogs." Or "Boy, what a neat dialysis machine you've made. I can't wait until my kidneys fail." Nobody has ever said to me, "That iBot is such a neat machine that I'm looking forward to that paralyzing auto accident." So I work very hard in the medical product area, and I go to bed always feeling really good when you know it works and you're helping people. But it's a whole different story than just watching people light up when you let them try the Segway Human Transporter.
Dean Kamen, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Dean Kamen invented many medical innovations as well as the Segway human transporter. Coming up, Ken Tucker reviews Shania Twain's new CD. This is Fresh Air. Country star Shania Twain's previous album, Come On Over, sold 19 million copies, thus becoming the sixth best-selling album of all time, tied with the Beatles' White Album. Rock critic Ken Tucker says Twain's new collection, called Up, is trying to guarantee similar success. It contains two discs, each with the same 19 songs, but one with country arrangements, the other recorded with rock instrumentation. Here's Ken's review.
In your arms, I can still feel the way you want me when you hold me. I can still hear the words you whispered when you told me. I can stay right here forever in your arms.
Like that song called Forever and For Always with its loping Johnny Cash-style rhythm? No? Then how about this version?
In your arms, I can still feel the way you want me when you hold me. I can still hear the words you whispered when you told me. I can stay right here forever in your arms.
That's the pop rock edition of Forever and For Always, with the fiddle and mandolin removed. I think that's the better version. Its arrangement is so clear and crisp. Its pretty melody and Twain's effulgent choral vocal leaps out at you. Twain's producer, who also happens to be her husband, is Mutt Lange, who made his rep by refining pop metal acts like Def Leppard and AC/DC. Lange specializes in isolating a song's hook and bringing it forward in the mix, giving it a propulsive spin that comes whipping at you like a razor-edged frisbee. Listen to the way he does it in the chorus of Up, the pop version.
It's about as bad as it could be. Seems everybody's bugging me. Like nothing wants to go my way, yeah, it just ain't been my day, nothing's coming easily. Even my skin is acting weird, I wish that I could grow a beard. Then I could cover up my spots, not play connect the dots, I just wanna disappear.
Selling listeners a package that contains two discs of the same songs sounds in theory like commercial cynicism. But it's actually fun to compare versions while being part of Mutt Lange's master plan to broaden Twain's fan base. A Canadian who's about as traditional country as Olivia Newton-John was when she stuffed herself down Nashville's throat 25 years ago, Twain doesn't have any authenticity issues to deal with. In a way, what Twain and Lange are doing is more honest than most current country stars who record watery pop songs, mix in a dobro and some pedal steel here and there, and expect Nashville to crown them the new George Jones or Patsy Cline. Twain couldn't care less about the grand tradition. In fact, overseas, there's yet a third version of these songs released, overdubbed with sitars and East Indian instrumentation. As she says on this song, she's out to get you, and it's only a matter of time and geography.
Let's go. Mm-hmm.
want you for a night. I'm only interested if I can have you for life. Yeah. I know I sound serious. Baby, I am. You're a fine piece of real estate and I'm gonna get me some land. Oh, yeah. So don't try to run, honey. Love can be fun. There's no need.
I can understand if you're put off by the slickness of this entire enterprise, but for me, in the right mood, this music can be like a drug. Its hooks are so addictive, I can listen to it over and over. Twain is making terrific pop, rock, country schlock, a new variation in a history of disposable music that would include everything from ABBA to the Archies. There's no point in being snobbish about it. Its allure is undeniable. It's gonna get you. It's just a matter of time.
Ken Tucker is critic at large for Entertainment Weekly. Fresh Air's executive producer is Jenny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, Monique Nazareth, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Patty Leswing, Ian Chillog, and Jessica Chu. I'm Terry Gross. We'll close with a recording by the trumpeter Ruby Braff. He died over the weekend, just a few weeks shy of his 76th birthday. He had been in declining health since September. This is Braff's 1988 recording of I'm Shootin' High, a song that was also recorded by the trumpeter who most influenced Braff, Louis Armstrong. Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by Harmony Books, a member of the Crown Publishing Group, a division of Random House Incorporated, publishers of 10 Poems to Open Your Heart by Roger Houston. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
The winter getaway, or summer vacation, is supposed to be the time when you relax and enjoy. So what does it say if you're still preoccupied, anxious, or depressed? On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Alan DeBotton about his new book, The Art of Travel. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.